Welcome to the History of California podcast. I'm your host, Jordan Maddox. Today, we're continuing our journey through the early works of John Steinbeck with a deep dive into his novel, Tortilla Flat. To help us explore its layers of myth, history, friendship, tragedy, and California placemaking, I'm joined by Dr. Michael Zeitler, a literary scholar, British literature specialist, deep Steinbeck reader, and former Monterey Bay Aquarium bookseller who brings a lifetime of insight into the cultural and ecological context that shapes Steinbeck's world. In this conversation, Dr. Zeitler and I unpack how Tortilla Flat bridges Steinbeck's early experiments with myth and archetype, how it reflects his grief and the cultural shifts of the early 20th century California, and why questions of community, poverty, masculinity, camaraderie, and place continue to resonate today. We explore how Steinbeck's novels form an interconnected epic of American history, from the Civil War to the mid-20th century, and why Tortilla Flat, despite its humor and lightness, sits squarely within that larger saga. Let's go meet Dr. Michael Zeitler. So, Dr. Zeitler, what is your favorite Steinbeck novel? I know we're talking about Tortilla Flat today. What is your favorite personally?
Oh, The Grapes of Wrath.
Okay.
In other words, that's my first kind of intro to Steinbeck. I'm in high school, and how do I put it? I saw the film, the old John Ford film, but I'm also into folk music and stuff like that. Woody Guthrie, Dust Bowl ballads and stuff, Pastures of Plenty. I'm into politics. And yeah, it's an eye-opener. It's a powerful read. So go from immediately from the book to the film, or from the film to the book. You know what I'm saying?
And yeah. Do you feel like Steinbeck's shorter work is overlooked by the broader public? East of Eden and Grapes of Wrath are the ones that get a lot of attention. Some of my favorites are In Dubious Battle. I love Pastures of Heaven, but they don't get the same kind of coverage. I think that's quality or just reputation?
On the one hand, things like The Pearl or Mice and Men are pretty embedded, you know, in the middle school, high school kind of curriculum.
Sure,
you know what I'm saying?
Yeah.
So those are there.
I guess maybe early work then maybe is overlooked, I guess maybe you could say.
Yeah, the Tortilla Flats and things like that, perhaps certainly to God Unknown, like you were doing before. But yeah, they're perhaps overlooked, but they're of interest to me because of how I see Steinbeck, which is very holistic.
Yeah.
In other words, I see Steinbeck as somebody who is coming at this period that interests me from basically after the Civil War period up until 100-year century, a Steinbeck century from the 1860s, 70s, from the time his grandparents and stuff come to California till his death in 68. Even one thing in terms of what you're talking about with East of Eden or something, this is some notes I was taking for another project I might be doing on Steinbeck eventually, but it's that Adam Trask, kind of cavalryman, Indian fighter, the new Adam, is discharged from the Presidio in San Francisco, end of the continent, can't go any further, as he says, west, right, in 1890. It's the same year of the end of the frontier, Frederick Jackson Turner kind of idea. Can't go any further. It's the closing date of the frontier. And for 3 years, Adam Trask wanders back east to his home kind of thing. But if you look at the descriptions of what he's doing there, I've got, Adam's life among the hobos, wandering men and lonely men who associate with other men for a week or a day, mice and men. Then those who worked a little, but not for long, and stole a little, but only food or clothes, Tortilla Flat. Those who sat around campfires and told Adam of the IWW In Dubious Battle and Grapes of Wrath, even though IWW didn't come around till 1905. Companions might be a murderer, Tom Joad, or an unfrocked priest, Grapes of Wrath kind of thing. A fallen angel, archangel, a devil in transition, each contributing bits of thought to the fire, each contributed carrots and potatoes and onions and meat to the stew. The saints and sinners of Cannery Row and Sweet Thursday. Adam pilfers the tide pools for abalones and eels and mussels and perch and lay in the sun-warm sand counting the waves, Cannery Row. He learns Spanish for food and pleasure, Tortilla Flat. This is just in a few pages. He's writing an outline of putting all of the novels into this epic kind of tale of California and the West, right?
That's incredible.
He learns that when people are very poor, they still have something to give and the impulse to give it. Grapes of wrath, right? He experiences the growing anger against the tramps and the quick brutality of police. Dubious battle, grapes of wrath. Prefiguring travels with Charlie, he experiences the racism of the South and hurries back to the Northeast. I'm saying, so that when I read the Steinbeck novels and the Steinbeck life or something, he's telling me something about American history from the Civil War to the 1960s that's extremely important to me in some personal way. You know what I'm saying? So yeah. It doesn't matter to me whether I'm reading it out of Cannery Row or I'm reading it out of Sweet Thursday or I'm reading it out of the East of Eden or the Grapes of Wrath. I think that the Grapes of Wrath is the one great novel that Stein wrote. That's why he has the Nobel Prize and all that. And it is, to me, one of the candidates for best great American novel kind of thing.
I just love that kind of that exposition there, because I love thinking about the big picture of the career of the writer and the evolution. And I just ordered that new collection of Seamus Heaney's, it's big, like 1,200 page tome that's just come out recently. And I'm excited to explore it and explore a poet that I love in terms of a span of a career.
I have the older one, the selected poems of it.
Well, if you need another doorstop, I've heard it's heavy.
And two, since British Lit is my field, I love teaching Beowulf out of Haney's translation.
Okay. Yeah.
I think, and in fact, it opened up in some ways to me how Beowulf works. And again, going back to the life of Haney and the Irish Troubles.
Yeah.
In other words, Beowulf is a poem about revenge. And it's like there's all these battles that Beowulf, and there's the story of the hero and the hero story. But throughout the poem, that hero story is all the time being interrupted by counter narratives that are basically talking about the futility of war and the futility of violence. Because the hero always is what? Killed one too many persons, and then those people want revenge, the whole thing. Haney is interesting to me as well.
Let me ask you about your British literature specialization, because you have done scholarship on one of my favorite writers in the English language, which is Thomas Hardy. His novels are so important to me. Jude the Obscure, Tess of D'Urberville's. I love all those books. And actually his poetry, which I have the full collected tome.
So do I. Thomas Hardy's
poetry. It's incredible how productive he was, but that's a whole different podcast. What I wanted to ask you was, I have a connection point between Hardy and Steinbeck, and I kind of wanted you to tell me if I'm off base here. It seems like they both are so dependent on place. Wessex for Hardy and the Monterey area, Salinas area for Steinbeck. Why do you think it's place is so important to both of them? Is there some kind of connection point there?
I think it's almost identical in the sense of it. And that I too can read Hardy's novels in a similar way. Okay. These are novels at one level of what the destruction of the working of the rural culture in England by modernization kind of thing. Right. It's easy to see to me in Tess of the D'Urbervilles, an itinerant worker going from farm to farm and becoming homeless and all of that kind of thing. Right. It's all there. The interest in ethnography, I think, is in both. One of the things I find about what with Steinbeck that interested me. Okay. My first interest was the political and the Grapes of Wrath. My second kind of interest came about in the 80s when I was a long period not going to school, doing other things, bookstores and stuff. And among the projects that I did, I was there at the Monterey Bay Aquarium in 1984 before it opened, and for the first few years it opened as one of the managers of the bookstore there kind of thing, right?
Yeah.
And so that connected me much deeper, first with Ricketts, and then with another favorite book of mine, Log of the Sea of Cortez. I love that book. And then with Between Pacific Tides, which to me is also in some ways literature, right? In fact, I've written about it as literature for this Encyclopedia of American Ecological Writing or something like that. We'll put Ricketts in there, or Steinbeck. That's as much Ricketts stuff as Steinbeck in there. But yeah, the sense of place is there, the sense of what, deep-rootedness, the sense of community, the sense of layering kind of thing that just was once what, Ohlone Indians, and then the Spanish were here, and then the Europeans came, and then layers and layers upon history, none of which disappear, but they're all what embedded in the narrative and getting
it's
at that
the geology of the landscape.
Yeah, all of that kind of thing. Yeah, and that's in Hardy as well.
What is, last question about your kind of British literature world, what is the view from that world, your colleagues, people that you work with, towards Western literature? How they like Western in the sense
Western
of like
American.
Western American literature is, I have this book club that I participated in, and one of the guys is the guy leading the book club is from the UK. And I think I brought up some kind of Steinbeck thing, and I wasn't dismissed. There's this kind of, there's a snobbery with British literature. How's your work in this area viewed?
Okay. I was working at the aquarium and decided I wanted to get out of just buying and selling books, but into writing about them and teaching them kind of thing. And I went back to UC Santa Cruz, which was my first degree. I had a degree in psychology, actually, from UC Santa Cruz. I went back to study literature there, and I was just overwhelmed by that cast of people that had written thousands of pages on Shakespeare and Milton. You know, all of that, Chaucer, you know what I'm saying? And okay, I'll do that. They impressed me.
Yeah.
And I went back to what? To Hopkins. I got a scholarship to go to Hopkins, Baltimore, and get that degree eventually, PhD. But at Hopkins, there was nothing about what? Western literature or Steinbeck or anything like that. More so at UC Santa Cruz, of course, because it's there. Oh, and what Lewis Owen, Steinbeck scholar, did teach there for a while, a Native American guy. But even people like what? Poet William Everson was teaching there. And
One of my favorites. I'm in Fresno, so you're preaching
in
the choir.
Of course, right. And I was thinking Wallace Stegner's son, Paige Stegner.
Okay.
Was teaching there at, critical creative nonfiction and stuff you would teach there for a long time.
Wow.
So, not Santa Cruz, no. Here's the thing about it that's crazy. I was going there and still working at the aquarium, right? And I just had too much work I was doing at the aquarium. And I went to Paige Stegner. I was going to take his class. And part of that class, you had to be free for a couple of weeks and go down the Colorado River and stuff. But I couldn't get the time off to do it. So I ended up taking Shakespeare or whatever and going that direction. If I could have, I might have gotten earlier into Steinbeck and all of that kind of thing. But going to the aquarium turned me into kind of the marine biology and the ecology and the Ricketts and all of those connections. Another aspect of my work into it was the Joseph Campbell kind of connections, right? Yeah. That's all there. You can't read that. And then, as I'm sure whatever others have talked about, that what vortex of energy in early 1931, 32, when you got people like Ricketts and Steinbeck and Joseph Campbell just sitting around with a gallon of wine and all of these books in multiple languages there and their typewriters and that, you know? All of that kind of things.
So let's jump into Tortilla Flat. I've got some kind of questions that are adjacent to Steinbeck's biography. So this is after reading the book and then also reading it, correspondingly the biography, this is a period of death when Tortilla Flat is published. He loses both of his parents. And I don't think we need a spoiler warning. This book's been out for almost 100 years. In the end, Danny, we can discuss what exactly his death is. There, it culminates in the death and the burning down of a house. Do you see that as like a connection to what he is going through writing this book as he sits with his mother as she dies?
Okay, what is this fire about kind of thing?
Yeah.
And psychologically or mythically and all of that. He's going to cast it mythically in terms of Camelot and whole, and Danny is the Fisher King and where's the healing and there is no healing. And I connected in the book with war. That essay that you read, right? I'm talking about kind of post-traumatic. The fact that it begins with him getting out and ends with after the after his death with a military funeral, right?
Yeah.
The gang all kind of there. They can't even have clothes to go to it. And the firing of the cannons and stuff there, the Presidio. I think that, sure, Steinbeck is what, early 30s still here?
Yeah.
He does something like that. He's not successful yet as a writer. He finds himself in this book. But it is a book about what? Letting go and death. Yeah, I agree.
Yeah. The other, we can jump in, you already gestured this, the kind of Arthurian mythology layered through this book. For you, what does that achieve for him? What's he trying to subvert with that? And what does it do for the meaning of what we're reading?
Okay. How do I put it? I think he's what? Experimenting on things that he'll get better at. In terms of using kind of these archetypes and these myths, perhaps a little over. Okay, I'm not art in the sense that it's not as though what Tortilla Flat is one of my what favorite books or et cetera. It fit the story I wanted to tell about Monterey and Cannery Row. And it's not, and to me, it's one of those books because what World War One comes up in East of Eden as well. It's what's dying is an old world. They've gotten to the end, right? It's the frontier is closed. It's where do we go from here? It's all settled in.
Yeah, you feel that sense of kind of decadence in the novel in an interesting way.
Okay, because it's not to me the decadence of having too much. It's the decadence of what? How does money play in here kind of thing? The exchange values are not about money. They're about gallons of wine. You
know? Yeah, that's the currency.
Buying it and what, that's the currency.
Yeah.
The way money plays into is almost as a fetish, right?
Yeah.
The only thing we need money for in this ultimately, and they worship it. They won't touch that. And when, you know, Big Joe gets into it for wine, they beat the shit out. They beat the crap out of them. You know what I'm saying? That money, this is interesting about money and how it plays in, is to buy a gold candlestick.
Yeah.
It's got a religious significance out of, indeed, Arthur, King Arthur.
Is that the Holy Grail
Holy
in some
Grail.
Ways?
All of that kind of is in there. I think it's clever, certainly. Works well for me. I don't know if, he's playing with that. Okay, and successfully in some levels.
Yeah, it's been interesting for me to read. There's pretty contentious debate about how Steinbeck portrays poverty, sentimentalizing it, caricaturing. How do you view the kind of contention that he's caricaturing impoverished people in these early novels?
In the intro to the Modern Library edition, he makes a kind of apology a little for that. Yeah, this has come up, this criticism. But on the other hand, it's not really an apology kind of thing.
Yeah.
You know what I'm saying? You're taking it too far that way. How do I feel about it? Okay, I put it in a context, and I was thinking about that. And so this is from Sea of Cortez, right? When they meet those Indians, assuming Indians that come in the canoes there, and then they go on land with them, and et cetera. And he says, so much evil the white man has brought to their ancestors. His breath was poisonous with a lung disease. To sleep with him was to poison the generations. Where he set down his colonies, the indigenous people withered and died. He brought industry and trade, but for prosperity, riches, but no ease. After 400 years of him, these people have ragged clothes and the shame that forces the wearing of them, iron harpoons for their hands, syphilis and tuberculosis, a few of the white man's less complex neuroses, and a curious devotion to a god who was sacrificed long ago in the white man's country. They know the white man is poisonous and they cover their noses against him. Okay, I take his portrayal in that context. You know what I'm saying? That he's using, these people not to what? Certainly not to ridicule them, but as an example, and it is caricature. Sure, the criticisms are accurate in some ways, but I have to take those criticisms within the context of how that's their country. They were there, you know what I'm saying? Of course, they took it from native peoples. It's all of a sudden what, they're not welcome there? To me, the moments in the book that come alive might be like the chapter with the corporal, they
Yeah.
call it. You know what I'm saying? It's Hemingway-esque.
Oh,
it's
yeah.
it's a story. It's he's read those Hemingway short stories and what Hemingway said about them. It's that every that the it, 9/10 of the feeling and the emotion and the meaning is below the surface. There's hardly anything on the surface. There's not a lot of simple sentences kind of thing, right? It's about the what? A teenage guy with a baby, right, that came up looking for work and can't find any work and is homeless on the street and treated meanly by a policeman kind of thing, not although not beaten or anything or not thrown in jail because of what Jesus Maria Corcoran, what interferes and says, oh, he's my buddy and takes him back to the place. And these people, Danny and the gang, are absolutely incompetent to help this guy. Maybe they can't. Maybe I would say, oh, we got to drive this guy to the emergency room. There's something wrong with this baby. You know what I mean?
That kind of pulls on a thread for me, because the first time I read it, and I've read it a couple times now, but first time I read it, I thought it was a comedy. Mm-hmm. Second time I read it, I thought it was a tragedy. The third time I read it, I didn't know what it was.
There's plenty of comic scenes in there.
Yeah.
But ultimately, it is, you know, what? Even in the sense of that Danny dies, right?
Yeah.
Yeah, it is a tragedy in that sense. But the things that happen to me, okay, you're writing a story about a dead baby.
Yeah.
I mean, that's the bottom line. There's nothing funny I can't get out of that.
Yeah.
And I don't think Steinbeck could. But I like the way he told it. Very Hemingway-esque. I'm not, no emotion in there. But if you, but to read it is to feel that emotion to me.
Yeah.
You know, and it comes
well,
to...
so let me ask you about this. This is something I also wrestle with in the book.
Right.
It feels like Danny and his motley crew are living by some kind of code. And that code breaks down at different points and it's there, but I don't exactly understand what the parameters of that code are. And because there's different points in the story where some things are tolerated that aren't tolerated in other parts. And so could you describe what the code that they're living by is exactly?
Okay, and maybe the model comes out of, in some ways, what some codes, like some code of chivalry, what it means to be a man.
Yeah.
You know what I'm saying? What do men owe each other? What does loyalty mean? What is respect? How? Okay, here's another part. I'll give you another kind of what, out of the example. I don't know if you've read Things Fall Apart by Joe Achebe.
Yeah, absolutely.
Okay, so we can talk about that. Did what? In there, okay, the Okonkwo's father is like these guys, right? He likes parties. He likes drinking. He likes playing music, right? He's a musician. He's not a warrior. He doesn't get any of that kind of stuff. And what? But how do we put? Achebe goes very deeply into the codes of how everybody relaxes, and he's accepted into the community kind of thing, right? And celebrated in the ways that he can. But it's in there, it's what, drinking the palm nut. I mean, you go through all these kind of rituals and meeting and kind of there. It is a very coded society in terms of how and what the people relax are. I think it may be, too, Steinbeck's kind of interest in anthropology, right? And I'm going to try to look at this society in how these codes work within here. What do you have to do? You have to offer the wine. If somebody says this, you can't say it directly, for example. You can't beg, borrow. You can't do any of that directly. You do it indirectly. You want to get the money for the bottle of wine from this person, but you can't just ask for it. Now you have to say something about how it's going to be good for them, how it will help them kind of thing, or they have this other problem, or we need to solve this other problem and then go around to it in the same way that what there's somebody in Things Fall Apart that's going to have a wedding and needs to call on Unoka for the money that he owes, right? And after they go through all of this ritual, trying to get to the point of after half hour or something, right? And finally, Unoka kind of points to the wall up there and he says, see all these marks and stuff? These are all the people what that I owe money. And you're there, like way down here. It's like, you're there. And as soon as the other seven people what get their cowrie shells, you're next. You can guarantee it. You're there. You're waiting. But don't you see, I've got to get these other seven people taken care of first. Anyway, that kind of what, those strategies of how people connect through a certain kinds of rituals, what you have to respect about other people and what and how you have to treat them. And in fact, the difference between that and their experience of the military, he says, because here he says, you can get beat up for something you did. But in the military, you can get thrown in jail and all these things for something you didn't do. You get to go to the stockade because you did not get up in time to go to the reveille in the morning or something, because you did not polish your shoes. What is this? It's a different kind of code. You know what I'm saying?
Yeah.
And that they live by a different kind of code. And I think probably in some level, Steinbeck is saying a certain thing about that. There's nothing wrong with different kinds of codes.
Yeah.
Or beyond simply that rejection of, I have to take what this Puritan, the Protestant ethic and capitalism and how they go together and how you be successful and what you have to do and what you have to do to the money and what's proper or improper and all of those kind of things. So I think that all of that's kind of part of the code that they have to live by.
It seems to me that you could probably do a Marxist reading of this novel fairly easily. The themes of alienation related to material objects, commerce, capitalism. Do you think that's too simple of a reading if someone were to look at it through that lens?
I'm wondering, okay. I would be, how do I put it? Some obviously dubious battle is going to demand such confrontation with those ideas.
Right,
Rapes of
right.
Wrath, of course, as well. Tortilla Flat. How useful would that be to see it that way?
Because it's really on the surface of the book. Right. I don't know if, do you see that, to dig down in this for a second, do you see the opposition between the moral code and then civilization? Is that in civilization represented through money and home?
Well, that's Western civilization or whatever.
Yeah, so that's an opposition. Would you say
right.
That's an opposition here?
Right.
Okay,
right.
So that's really the critique in a lot of ways.
And two, okay, and how do we put it? That the book, in some ways, as does Cannery Row, kind of avoid to a large degree that's where the opposition is. In
right.
other words, that's where workers are going down, paid X amount of dollars per hour to work for canneries. And what's the business of canneries? And how does that change fishing, especially when you get big kind of boats that can catch lots of fish rather than, you know what I mean, individuals trying to catch fish. The economics of Cannery Row, the economics of the sardine industry, all of that is, it's there. And the people, but the people use that as, okay, if I go to work for 6 hours, I'll get X amount of money and then I can buy a bottle of wine. That's that type of thing. It's not really addressing kind of those issues. I don't see that as the primary focus that what Steinbeck is trying to get out of an analysis of the economics of Cannery Row or Tortilla Flat. Maybe that one of the things about looking at the book is that to some degree, a lot of it is done in a satirical kind of mode.
Yeah.
So we have pirate that goes around with his dogs and hits all of the restaurants and then goes to the wood. I mean,
That is one of my favorite stories in there, the pirate. I don't feel like I understand necessarily what's going on there, but they're hilarious and fascinating.
Right. They're hilarious. But it's also that this is a homeless person whose life is as rigid. You know what I'm saying? It's controlled. It's not like he's deviates from this, or he doesn't spend any money uselessly, doesn't spend money at all. He goes, he gets the free food, he splits it up 7 ways so the dogs all get some, and then he splits it up with people there, so he has to work a little harder, but he gets a free place to live. Not that he needs a free place to live, but he needs companionship. He needs friends. He was too lonely. They bring him in. He becomes part of the community kind of thing.
Yeah, what would you say Steinbeck's kind of thesis of friendship is from this novel? Is it... because the characters are all interacting in different ways, but they still
right.
feel like they're part of almost like an organism that is kind of moving. You know?
Okay, and that goes to the work that comes out in The Pearl and comes out in comes out in Grapes of Wrath, Dubious Battle, that collective kind of organism, the biological kinds of things, how the community around in The Pearl is actually an organism.
Yeah.
All of that. And that's, that's the whole Ricketts in the tide pool that Steinbeck kind of learned, I think, a lot of that from. Ricketts' sense of biology there, and that sense of, yeah, in the tide pool, it's not that they're good or bad. It's, you know what I'm saying? It's the interactions of all of them and everyone just as necessary kind of thing.
It feels claustrophobic at some point. Right. You're just like, you're surrounded.
That pirate, performs a valuable service to the community, going around and collecting this and supplying people with wood and taking care of the dogs and, all of that kind of thing.
Yeah,
I mean, so it is a celebration of people's lives type of thing. The other aspect, again, to move a little into Cannery Row, that I like about Steinbeck and that I saw there is that essay that I read, I made a big deal about something that you see a lot of in Steinbeck, and that is car mechanics. And it took me a number of readings before I realized, for instance, not just there, but in The Grapes of Wrath, how these scenes and what's going on in the scenes is, okay, these two characters, what are they doing? They're in a junkyard, right? And they're looking for a master cylinder for a 1922 or whatever, Hudson or something that'll work. And they're going through all these cars and then they find one that works and then they take it apart and they bring it back and they put it back in. And the other people in there are grinding gears and they're there's so much car mechanics going on while they're talking politics and community kinds of things. And it struck me that, okay, one of the things that Steinbeck was saying in Cannery Row is that how all these guys there, they knew how to fix cars. There's scenes of the fixing cars. And then another book, and I'll put this on there beside the novel Grapes of Wrath, and I also put Log of Sea of Cortez, but as an unknown Steinbeck book, okay, that I think is worth reading would be There Once Was a War.
Okay.
It's his World War II journalism for that period in which he was in North Africa and Europe during the war, doing the kind of Ernie Pyle kind of thing with the soldiers. And it's to me, that was the heart of one of the things I was trying to get at in that essay, that sense of that these guys who were the Flophouse guys there were fighting fascism. They were over there doing that. The skills of thousands and thousands of high school guys never going to go to college or anything like that, right? We're going to defeat Hitler. And the same boys that were playing and fixing up that old car in the garage or with their friends or something to race down the streets are doing the same thing over in this massive in North Africa doing this, right? And that the guy that we saw in Cannery Row, who was fixing the car so they could get it to go on the frog hunt and stuff, Gay, when they come back after the war, his bed is empty. He somehow died in Italy, all of that. And that Steinbeck is celebrating that. And I realized then too, because my experiences, of course, with Steinbeck in the 60s were somewhat disappointing. Because I mean, I was protesting the wars, all of this stuff, and Steinbeck was not doing, he was the opposite. He was celebrating. And I'm trying to figure out why his, not celebrating, but in favor of Johnson's war over there. Partly because he saw in Johnson the guy who was working on the Great Society and who shared those Roosevelt kind of values. But also because when he went over there, I think what he was seeing is he identified with the working class kids over there. He's not going to identify with privileged me at the university, but he is going to identify with those working kids over there, whether or not the war was justified or whether it was being run right or anything like that. But that's the part of the community, because we see in There Once Was a War, the way he talks about the soldiers, the way they become a unit, the way they bond, all of the camaraderie between them is similar in some ways to what the camaraderie of the Cannery Row or the Paisanos. But it was focused in a way that theirs wasn't. I don't know.
Yeah.
Something to think about, whatever.
Yeah, no, those are great thoughts. I want to deal now directly with Danny's denouement, if you will, the ending here, because each time I've read it, I've approached it differently, depending on how I read the rest of the novel preceding. And I've come to a place where I have started to see the house as Danny and Danny as the house. And it's effectively a funeral pyre at the end. But it also makes me think, if Danny's the house, then, you know, Danny also needed to be liberated from the house in the way he was liberated from his body to finally be free. How do you look at the burning of the house?
Or was there a place anymore for Danny to be free?
Yeah.
That might be the other aspect of it. You know what I'm saying? That,
yeah.
Okay, he had to be free of the house. So we're going to burn the house down, but we burn,
yeah.
But I'm trying to just think, where does Danny fit in? You
yeah.
know what I mean? He's got mm-hmm. a kind of, again, Steinbeck didn't have a name for it called what? Post-traumatic stress disorder or something. But it says, like when we first meet him, how his legs, what, shaped to somebody who rides what? Horses all the time. He works on farms. And what got destroyed with that? He goes to the military apparently, and what is a mule skinner for the military or something. But what happens to him? We don't know. We don't know what happens to him between what? The cowboy who could what? Go on a binge and then get back to work or something. And the person who could go on a binge when it kept lasting because he didn't have any what work to do. Maybe that's an economic kind of issue that's not explored. In what ways is Monterey changing that there's no place for Danny? I don't know.
Yeah, maybe it's that term that's become parlance now, deaths of despair. You
yeah.
know, maybe this is a prototype of that in some ways.
Mm,
But yeah, it feels layered with meaning, and that's the mark of great literature, is that we can just
I think that
rehash.
The first time I read it many years ago, I was just dumbfounded by this. What a weird ending to the book, right?
Yeah,
why
yeah.
did we have to end it? What's the matter? What did he is it but and two, is it what we know? He's found at the bottom of a gully. We also know he's had probably a massive amount of alcohol. So it probably was, and it is too, okay. He takes that what? That armchair or something, or that leg of a chair or something, and starts swinging it around. What that reminded me of, okay, would be August Wilson's play Fences. You know?
Yeah. I'm in
Where
my library and I see Fences across from me. I'm looking at it right now. Yes,
where Troy, at the end of it, I see that debt's going to throw me a fastball or maybe a curve, but I'm going to get ready. I'm going to murder,
yeah,
swinging that bat that way. Yeah, or to use an even older one or something, at the death of what, Cyrano de Bergerac or something, the old play with his waving his sword in the air. And I don't know. It is military, though. It's man as warrior, man as fighter, and fighting death.
Well, and I know that Steinbeck was also simultaneously working on In Dubious Battle, working on this. We're going to be moving on to that book in this next podcast series. What can you tell us about what to anticipate with In Dubious Battle?
Oh, okay. Here we're going to get the first time what his trying to Steinbeck's sense of what history and how history moves and what it takes to move large numbers of people, and then the how do we put it, the need for what, on the one hand, unity, comradeship, unity, all for one to accomplish this, and on the other hand, the things that Freud talks about in group psychology, and where what there's the danger, as it were, in losing one's individuality in this big mass that's going forward, right? I mean, he's, how do I put it? In one of the ways, I think what Steinbeck is dealing with in a lot of these books is the transformations of society, it's Hardy too, right? From a traditional world into the what? The modern world kind of thing, right? Traditional world being oral, the traditional world being much more static, the traditional world being more religious, all of these things, communal and the modern world, et cetera, urban. And that in itself becomes a kind of a tragedy because people get caught up in that kind of, they're born in one world and what? They can't adapt to this other world. And the other world has no compunction about what, just steamrolling over them. You know what I'm saying? And those kind of issues, which are essentially tragic kind of issues.
Yeah, this is a California history podcast, so I'd be remiss if I didn't ask you a couple California questions. Do you think this novel could have been written in Seattle as a setting? Or do you think there's something specific to the context here that only makes sense in this context?
To me, it only makes sense in this context. I can't imagine what.
Yeah, you could imagine similar landscape in some ways, similar group of guys wandering around the periphery.
Part of my problem with doing that is an intense attachment that I have to no place else but that area. 25 years or so of my life, right? I moved out of Santa Cruz to go to Hopkins and never quite got able to go back. Yeah. And then I looked at the house that we bought for $60,000 at one point, and it's still a little beach shack, and now it's $1.3 million or something. How do I get back?
Yeah, that's change. Yeah.
Or even, how do I put it, that all of my political values and all the things that we're trying to do and the changes that we made in Santa Cruz so many years ago and the bringing the university there and the ideals, it's done wonders in some ways of opening up the world to minorities and opening up the world to gay people and all kinds of in that personal sense. But economically, I miss Santa Cruz 1975 or something.
Yeah,
it's a different world.
Yeah.
Steinbeck had to leave it too. Yeah. I think it was interesting too that Joseph Campbell called Monterey Bay his paradise.
I think it's interesting to read Steinbeck and Companion with Robinson Jeffers and just look and see how they both look at the changing world around them. We could go on forever, but I'm going to conclude with book recommendations. These can be Steinbeck related or just stuff you'd like to recommend. But first, before we get to yours, I'm curious, what's your favorite Thomas Hardy novel? Which one do you come back to the most?
Probably Tess.
Tess. Okay, why?
How about you?
Me, probably Jude.
Okay.
Yeah. Why Tess for you?
Something about Tess that I fall in love with.
Yeah.
I like to protect her or something. I don't know.
Well, I'm wanderer, so I like Jude just wandering without, and then just life happening to him.
And for drama, I also like the mayor of Casterbridge a lot.
Oh, yeah. Yeah. I feel like it's been a number of years since I read that. I need to go back.
To me, after Shakespeare, I think that Hardy is perhaps our greatest tragic writer in the British tradition.
Yeah.
I mean,
I just read Bleak House for the first time recently over that.
Okay. But I don't see Dickens' ultimate tone as being tragic. I mean, massive in a different way, but that in a classic kind of sense, almost that Henchard or Tess or Jude are as tragic, as tragic characters, almost a classic kind of sense.
Yeah. Oh, so anyway, let's go back to your book recommendations. What would you like to recommend to listeners?
Okay, the one I wanted to recommend was, I already did in a sense, I think that people might be interested in Steinbeck as, I like Steinbeck's journalism.
Yeah.
His nonfiction. And I think that that's useful. The one, Once There Was a War. Okay. So that would be from Steinbeck, again, other than the great novels and Long from the Sea of Cortez. Other recommendation? California? Angle of Repose? I don't know. You've done
Sell that book because that's one of my favorites. So just tell people, because it's an investment of time. So why should people spend time with Wallace for that long?
Okay. I've read a lot of Stegner's novels. I like Big Rock, Candy Mountain. They're really good books. They're very interesting. Steinbeck or Wallace Stegner as a Western writer and his nonfiction kind of thing. If you're interested in Western writing, I like Stegner a lot.
Fantastic.
So that might be a good podcast story at some point.
I want
to do Stegner.
Yeah.
And the fact of Stegner's influence, teaching at Stanford and all the people that went through that.
Oh, yeah.
That.
He's got
Ken Kesey, the Ernest J. Gaines.
Tree of thinkers and writers that come from.
Right. And so all of that's interesting.
Fantastic. Okay, Dr. Zeitler, to close, what are you working on these days?
I've been all over the place. I've been working a lot on Emerson.
Okay.
Okay. I'm moving away from the British stuff. I'm not in the right atmosphere to teach it so much. And it seems somewhat less relevant to me right now to deal with trying to get my students interested in Pride and Prejudice, that type of thing, when all that's going on in the world.
Yeah.
But teaching and stuff, I've been teaching things like utopian and dystopian literature and that kind of thing is in addition to the British stuff. Emerson, and especially I see in African-American literature a certain strand of very Emersonian thinking, from Frederick Douglass to Du Bois to Ralph Ellison to Baldwin, kind of thing, that very American in that sense, right? In that Emersonian sense of America.
Yeah. Dr. Seitler, this has been a lot of fun. Thank you so much for
Sure.
talking to
I've
me and
enjoyed it. Okay.
Giving us some perspective, additional perspective on Tortilla Flat. And I encourage people to, this interested you, go pick up the book. It's a great read. It's a fantastic read. It's a fast read. So, it's maybe a long Saturday afternoon with a beer on the couch, and you have a great afternoon. Dr. Zeitler, thanks again.
Okay. Thank you.
Thanks for listening, everyone. If you enjoyed this podcast, please consider supporting us by either giving us a rating and review or by making a financial contribution at our Patreon page, which is www.patreon.com/historyofcalifornia. We'll see you next time.